The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Part 2, The Integral Knowledge, Chapter 17, page 426, The Soul and Nature. This is the result of the integral knowledge taken in its mass. Its work is to gather up the different strands of our being into the universal oneness. If we are to possess perfectly the world in our new divinized consciousness, as the Divine Himself possesses it, we have to know also each thing in its absoluteness. First, by itself. Secondly, in its union with all that completes it. For so has the Divine imaged out and seen its being in the world. To see things as parts, as incomplete elements, is a lower analytic knowledge. The Absolute is everywhere. It has to be seen and found everywhere. Every finite is an infinite and has to be known and sensed in its intrinsic infiniteness as well as in its surface finite appearance. But so to know the world, so to perceive and experience it, it is not enough to have an intellectual idea or imagination that so it is. A certain divine vision, divine sense, divine ecstasy is needed. An experience of union of ourselves with the objects of our consciousness. In that experience, not only the beyond, but all here, not only the totality, the all in its mass, but each thing in the all becomes to us ourself, God, the Absolute, and Infinite, Satchidananda. This is the secret of complete delight in God's world, complete satisfaction of the mind and heart and will, complete liberation of the consciousness. It is the supreme experience at which art and poetry and all the various efforts of subjective and objective knowledge and all desire and effort to possess and enjoy objects are trying, more or less obscurely, to arrive. Their attempt to seize the forms and properties and qualities of things is only a first movement which cannot give the deepest satisfaction unless, by seizing them perfectly and absolutely, they get the sense of the infinite reality of which these are the outer symbols. To the rational mind and the ordinary sense experience, this may well seem only a poetic fancy or a mystic hallucination. But the absolute satisfaction and sense of illumination which it gives and alone can give is really a proof of its greater validity. We get by that a ray from the higher consciousness and the diviner sense into which our subjective being is intended eventually, if we will only allow it to be transfigured. We have seen that this applies to the highest principles of the divine being. Ordinarily, the discriminating mind tells us that only what is beyond all manifestation is absolute. Only the formless spirit is infinite. Only the timeless, spaceless, immutable, immobile self, in its repose, is absolutely real. And if we follow and are governed in our endeavor by this conception, that is the subjective experience at which we shall arrive, all else seeming to us false, or only relatively true. But if we start from the larger conception, a completer truth and a wider experience open to us. We perceive that the immutability of the timeless, baseless existence is an absolute and an infinite, but that also the conscious force and the active delight of the divine being in its all-blissful possession of the outpouring of its powers, qualities, self-creations, is an absolute and an infinite. And indeed, the same absolute and infinite, so much the same that we can enjoy simultaneously, equally the divine timeless calm and peace, and the divine time-possessing joy of activity, freely, infinitely, without bondage or the lapse into unrest and suffering. So, too, we can have the same experience of all the principles of this activity, which in the immutable are self-contained and, in a sense, drawn in and concealed. In the cosmic are expressed and realize their infinite quality and capacity. The first of these principles in importance is the duality, which resolves itself into a unity of Purusha and Prakriti, of which we have had occasion to speak in the Yoga of Works, but which is of equal importance for the Yoga of Knowledge. This division was made most clearly by the old Indian philosophies, but it bases itself upon the eternal fact of practical duality in unity upon which the world manifestation is founded. It is given different names according to our view of the universe. The Vedantins spoke of the self and Maya, meaning according to their predilections by the self, the immutable, and by Maya, the power the self has of imposing on itself the cosmic illusion, or by the self, the divine being, and by Maya, the nature of conscious being, and the conscious force by which the divine embodies himself in soul forms and forms of things. Others spoke of Ishwara and Shakti, the Lord and his force, his cosmic power. The analytic philosophy of the Sankhyas affirmed their eternal duality without any possibility of oneness, accepting only relations of union and separation by which the cosmic action of Prakriti begins, proceeds, or ceases for the Purusha. For the Purusha is an inactive conscious existence. It is the soul, the same in itself and immutable forever. Prakriti, the active force of nature, which by its motion creates and maintains, and by its sinking into rest dissolves the phenomenon of the cosmos. Leaving aside these philosophical distinctions, we come to the original psychological experience from which all really take their start, that there are two elements in the existence of living beings, of human beings at least, if not of all cosmos, a dual being, nature and the soul. This duality is self-evident. Without any philosophy at all, by the mere force of experience, it is what we can all perceive, although we may not take the trouble to define. Even the most thoroughgoing materialism, which denies the soul or resolves it into a more or less illusory result of natural phenomena, acting upon some ill-explained phenomenon of the physical brain, which we call consciousness, or the mind, but which is really no more than a sort of complexity of nervous spasms, cannot get rid of the practical fact of this duality. It does not matter at all how it came about. The fact is not only there, it determines our whole existence. It is the one fact which is really important to us as human beings with a will and an intelligence and a subjective existence which makes all our happiness and our suffering. The whole problem of life resolves itself into this one question. What are we to do with this soul and nature set face to face with each other? We who have as one side of our existence this nature, this personal and cosmic activity, which tries to impress itself upon the soul, to possess, control, determine it, and as the other side, this soul, which feels that in some mysterious way it has a freedom, a control over itself, a responsibility for what it is and does, and tries therefore to turn upon nature, its own and the world's, and to control, possess, enjoy, or even, it may be, reject and escape from her. In order to answer that question, we have to know what the soul can do, to know what it can do with itself, to know, too, what it can do with nature and the world. The whole of human philosophy, religion, science, is really nothing but an attempt to get at the right data upon which it will be possible to answer the question and solve, as satisfactorily as our knowledge will allow, the problem of our existence. The hope of a complete escape from our present strife with and subjection to our lower and troubled nature and existence arises when we perceive what religion and philosophy affirm. But modern thought has tried to deny that there are two poises of our soul existence, a lower, troubled and subjected, a higher, supreme, untroubled and sovereign, one vibrant in mind, the other tranquil in spirit, the hope not only of an escape, but of a completely satisfying and victorious solution comes when we perceive what some religions and philosophies affirm, but others seem to deny, that there is also in the dual unity of soul and nature a lower, an ordinary human status, and a higher, a divine. For it is in the divine alone that the conditions of the duality stand reversed. There the soul becomes that which now it only struggles and aspires to be, master of its nature, free, and by union with the divine, possessor also of the world nature. According to our idea of these possibilities will be the solution we shall attempt to realize. Involved in mind, possessed by the ordinary phenomenon of mental thought, sensation, emotion, reception of the vital and physical impacts of the world and mechanical reaction to them, the soul is subject to nature. Even its will and intelligence are determined by its mental nature, determined even more largely by the mental nature of its environment, which acts upon, subtly as well as overtly, and overcomes the individual mentality. Thus, its attempt to regulate, to control, to determine its own experience and action is pursued by an element of illusion. Since when it thinks it is acting, it is really nature that is acting and determining all it thinks, wills, and does. If there were not this constant knowledge in it that it is, that it exists in itself, is not the body or life, but something other, which at least receives and accepts the cosmic experience if it does not determine it. It would be compelled in the end to suppose that nature is all and the soul an illusion. This is the conclusion modern materialism affirms, and to that nihilistic Buddhism arrived. The Sankhyas, perceiving the dilemma, solved it by saying that the soul, in fact, only mirrors nature's determinations, and itself determines nothing, is not the Lord, but can, by refusing to mirror them, fall back into eternal immobility and peace. There are, too, the other solutions which arrive at the same practical conclusion, but from the other end, the spiritual. For they affirm either that nature is an illusion, or that both the soul and nature are impermanent, and they point us to a state beyond, in which their duality has no existence. Either they cease by the extinction of both in something permanent and ineffable, or their discordances end by the exclusion of the active principle altogether. Though they do not satisfy humanity's larger hope and deep-seated impulse and aspiration, these are valid solutions, so far as they go, for they arrive at an absolute in itself, or at the separate absolute of the soul, even if they reject the many rapturous infinities of the absolute, which the true possession of nature by the soul in its divine existence offers to the eternal seeker in man. Uplifted into the spirit, the soul is no longer subject to nature. It is above this mental activity. It may be above it in detachment and aloofness, udashina, seated above and indifferent, or attracted by and lost in the absorbing peace or bliss of its undifferentiated, its concentrated spiritual experience of itself. We must then transcend by a complete renunciation of nature and cosmic existence, not conquer by a divine and sovereign possession, but the spirit, the divine, is not only above nature, it is master of nature and cosmos. The soul, rising into its spiritual poise, must at least be capable of the same mastery by its unity with the divine. It must be capable of controlling its own nature, not only in calm or by forcing it to repose, but with a sovereign control of its play and activity.